I know it's strange, but my brain's gone really insane. And I'm off the chain, sipping on a fifth for the...
Oh, you sound good. Just keep talking, man.
Check. How do I sound?
Good, good. Oh, I have this really hardcore backdrop because the light's coming in. I'm like ready to do a...
an anonymous interview, yeah.
This is hard. I have a new toy. This is the Zoom L6 live track.
So that goes in the vagina or the anus?
Okay. Was there anything you specifically wanted to talk about?
Well, I think Did
somebody else fall through? Is that what happened?
Yeah, exactly. but this is an emergency podcast because there's some breaking news out of France. President Macron has been slapped by his wife on an airplane in Vietnam. And so you are our French correspondent. This is the slap heard round the world. Obviously, this is going to reverberate in a lot of ways, much like Trump's tariffs have and the election in France before it. So we need to get your take. What he says, this was all a play fight. It was just a simple love tap. But I think, you know, you and I have seen the video. It appears to be...
I have not seen the video.
Oh, okay. Wow.
I was at work today, and I just looked at my phone, and Andy asked me, do you want to come on the Intifada? And I said, of course. And
well,
I reported
this is great.
For duty.
I will present, and we can watch it in real time. All right. So he is on a plane. You see it here? So this is a slow-mo. You see the hand come in, slap him around the neck.
Oh, he was slapped.
Yeah.
By his wife slash teacher.
His elder mistress wife. So here, let's see it again. Oh, now he's walking out as if nothing happened, and his wife walks out as if nothing happens. But we all saw it on video.
I've been slapped harder than that.
By your wife?
Not by my wife. But in a past life, I was slapped harder than that. No, I think it's, I don't know. There's this weird fixation with Brigitte because, you know, there's this whole conspiracy theory about her being trans or whatever.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I think it's a replay of the old conspiracy theory about Michelle Obama.
It's very similar, but I haven't looked into it. I haven't transvestigated Brigitte myself. Do you think there's anything to it?
No, well, I wouldn't know one way or the other. And when it comes to a slap like that, I mean, unless Emmanuel, I don't know. We don't know what their sort of rules of their relationship are. I don't know what his safe word is.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, this could be something that is totally normal and fine in the relationship. Or, you know, maybe some people should reach out to him and you know, gently see if there's... Yeah. He needs a place to go for a bit.
He could need help. It is interesting, though, to think about the relationship of, like, him being this figurehead. You know, he's the president of the republic. His wife probably shouldn't be slapping him in public view like that.
Yeah, did Hera slap Zeus? I don't think so.
So what did you have me on here to talk about, Andy?
Well, you know, besides this, you know, the most important news of the slap, we could talk about the new international. We could talk about Mélenchon's recent U.S. tour.
Oh,
we
yeah.
We can talk about the new pope, which there's an article about in the recent new international.
Yeah.
We can talk about whatever's on your mind.
Well, I would say that, first of all, I want to give big props to comrade Antoine Salas-Papou, who saved the old man, as we call Mélenchon, multiple times on his North American tour.
That's his translator?
When the translation situation did not work. Mm. Did you see these recordings or not?
No, the only thing I saw was a bit of his interview with Hassan. And that was in France.
Oh, yeah. That was in France. And Hassan, you know, did well. And, you know, it was predicted that he would have problems after talking to Mélenchon. And he did have problems after talking to Mélenchon at the border. So... solidarity with Hassan and everybody getting
pushed
around at the
Hassan
border.
Hassan got detained at the Chicago airport by customs or border. It was by Homeland Security. Yeah, he's detained by Homeland Security. Do you think that was because he talked to Mélenchon?
Partly, probably not entirely. But I mean, he was going around talking to people about politics. From what I saw, there was this report that people were, you know, questioning him about what's your view on Trump and stuff like that. So clearly, there was a political angle to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Antoine did a good job translating for him. And a really funny episode happened when the two were at the DSA meetup that they did with Jamal Bowman and Tiffany Caban. Her first name is Tiffany, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And there were some other people there, but I forget. Apologies if you're listening. And, you know, at one point, I believe Caban asked Mélenchon a question, and he was going on and on and on and on. And at the end, he like made a joke or something and was like looking around a bit like, where's the response from the punchline? And everybody just looked and said, like, we have to have it translated to understand. And actually, Antoine, because the machine broke down, Antoine had to do the whole discourse, like one shot. Mm. And at the end, Bowman was like, thanks, everybody. You know what I mean? Good job.
Yeah. I mean, I've had that experience before, and excuse of a failure to translate would be helpful for when my jokes fall flat.
When your jokes fall flat is a regular occurrence on the Antifada program. But no, I think it was good. I noticed there was a pretty big difference, I think, in the reception that he had in Montreal and in New York, probably just because of this very reason.
Yeah.
Somebody told me that they had a friend at the CUNY event who said that it was like a rehabilitation of Trotskyism, which I found to be completely bizarre as an interpretation of what was said, because I watched, you know, the recording and I understand the language. And I also read reports that a lot of people that do speak French or are French citizens were afraid to come to the event, and that there were also like journalists who didn't come and stuff like this. So I'm a little bit confused about the U.S. situation. Was it dangerous for the old man to come to America? Would they have like put him in El Salvador or something?
They were afraid to come because they'd be on like a list of known leftists, perhaps.
Something like that. I mean, I don't. Yeah. I'm not like, you know, plugged into all of the discussions. I wasn't there, but that's what I was sort of heard secondhand or third hand.
Well, for sure, a lot of people are very nervous about travel because these horror stories have circulated. You know, I think Hassan's case is a particularly notable one, and I think Hassan handled it very well. It's not, obviously, it's not good to talk to law enforcement without a lawyer, but he felt it was a good thing to do it to see what they wanted to ask. And he seemed to be prepared enough to understand that you, in those situations, if you are going to talk, you don't lie. You don't let them bait you into something that could be construed as a lie or construed as something for them to detain you further. But he wanted to get the information about why he was being detained, what they were interested in asking him, in order to report back about his experience. So he took that on knowing that he is a wealthy person, he has a lawyer, he is a public figure, that it would be a big story and that he could publicize it. And his interpretation of why he specifically was detained was that it was a chilling effect to make people scared to criticize Trump and to travel after criticizing Trump. Or if you're not a citizen of the United States, like Hassan is, to travel in general or to stay in the country long term. So I think he did a pretty good job of feeling out that situation. He probably expected it to be coming. And in general, you know, these sorts of detentions have happened prior to Trump. You know, I think we have friends who, coming back from foreign voyages, have been detained and questioned, and they were not serious detentions. It's just sort of like you're on a list. Homeland Security wants to know what you were doing over there. But certainly the angle of like, why are you criticizing Trump? Why are you criticizing Israel? What's your opinion about Hamas? Have you ever talked to Hamas? These sorts of things are totally inappropriate to ask a journalist, but not exactly 100% new. Obviously, I think Homeland Security has been weaponized in many ways under Trump. But, you know, I have had friends who have traveled recently who have not had this experience, so hopefully it is not quite as common as we might fear.
I would hope so. And I would say also about Hassan, like, I don't, you know, I express solidarity with him in this ordeal that he went through. He seems like he's, you know, strong on his two feet and he doesn't really need to worry about anything. I will say that I'm not familiar with his whole, like, oeuvre, and I'm not sure how someone could be, given that my understanding of his profession is that he talks on the internet for, like, I don't know, what is it, like 20 hours a week or something like that?
Yeah, what kind of sick loser weirdo would sit and watch Hassan on Twitch all day, every day? I can't even imagine. I mean, I
would. No, I'm saying what kind I of sit, you know, agent is sitting room. There like, I got to go through all these hours of footage. I got to find the incriminating thing. Because that is just a fundamental issue. Is if you're, you know, on here shooting the shit and asking me about, you know, Brigitte Macron, there could be somebody really pissed off that we didn't take the slap seriously, and then, like, they'll be in my mentions. But imagine if you did that for 20 hours a week.
Well, you know, I was just making a joke at my own expense because I watch a lot of Hassan.
you're familiar with his own.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. He's my handsome big brother. But,
well, you know, Mélenchon said he was the most interesting American that he'd met.
He is an interesting guy, and he's very smart. And it is very impressive not only how long he streams and how he's able to hold attention and how he's able to, you know, strategically, I don't want to say he radicalizes people, but he talks people through his politics and does a fairly good job of it. But also, it's really impressive how informed he stays despite how much time he spends yelling at Zoomers on his chat. You know, I like he knows his shit, and it's really impressive. But let's get back to Mélenchon.
I hope Hassan reads the book, because Mélenchon gave him a copy of the book, mm-hmm. Now the People, Revolution in the 21st Century, available from Verso Books. And hopefully Hassan reads it and talks about it. I will say that I also heard from this tour that Mélenchon was a bit concerned that nobody in America talked to him about ecology.
Yes, and this is actually exactly what I was going to bring up, is that that was the most striking comment that I saw him make in that Hassan interview, that he was actually just shocked that the U.S. left had sort of tabled this issue. And, you know, I think we're guilty of that to some extent on this show. You know, I'm reading Malcolm Harris's book now, which is about the climate crisis and what it's going to take to solve it. So hopefully we're going to have an episode about that soon. But in general, yes, this is an issue that was talked about quite a lot over the last 10 years, and these days much less so, because, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is, I think it's reasonable to think we need some major change in leadership in this country if there is going to be any meaningful dealing with this problem. And the other part is that it's just a kind of a non-starter politically, because without mass collective action on it, mass collective international action on it, there really isn't a solution. We are really just heading towards the cliff, and we're gonna, you know, see if we can somehow only break one leg in the fall or something.
Yeah, and that comes back to something that Mélenchon said recently. I believe it was at his speech in Auxerre. It might have been in Aubenas. I might be confusing them. But at a speech in Auxerre, he basically resumed his voyage to the public and was saying that, you know, in America, all the leftists he met were depressed and defeated because Trump won the election. And Trump won the election because there is no left. Mm-hmm. Or there was no left on the ballot, so to speak.
Exactly.
And I think that's, you know, I still believe that analysis. I think that's correct. I think that there is a need for an American radical left, which is something that I called for, you know, last November. I was recently talking to a friend who told me he didn't know what the radical left was. So for New International, I'm working on a piece trying to explain this concept. We can workshop it now or, you know, pivot away from that topic. Regarding ecology, we recently published a friend of Mélenchon, Pierre-Yves Cadillan, on the defeat of biopolitics, which is probably our most heady thing.
Very ill-will style headline at New International, newintermag.com. And I thought, yeah, I must have accidentally went to Ill Will editions, but this is a testament to the heterodox, is that the word I'm thinking? Yeah, heterodox nature of your publication is that you've got stuff about the Pope, you've got stuff about biopolitics, you've got stuff about, what else you got here? You got like a May Day message from Francis Parney, Workers of the World Unite. You have something about assisted suicide or social murder, you know, going back to some of the discussions we had on the last episode. You have something about
AI.
That's
actually a major issue right now in the European left. This isn't really a topic in America, is it? The end of life stuff.
It's more so in Canada. And we had a great discussion on our Discord following our chat about the ethics of death with dignity, as I call it.
Yeah, so it's actually very interesting. Within the French context, we're currently actually in France and in the UK, it's a sort of parallel thing where there are death with dignity type legislation moving forward in the respective parliaments. In the UK, it's getting a lot of pushback because it's paired with the Starmright Labour austerity program where they're slashing palliative care. Mm-hmm. So the article that we recently put out by Joe Gallagher goes into that. And I think his article, you know, I worked with him editing on it. I think he did a very good job of sourcing everything that he said. It's not just like vague arguments about slippery slopes. He goes in and talks about the stats, the figures, et cetera, et cetera. I think his argument, you know, someone could make a counter argument, but the idea that assisted dying is a class issue where certain groups of people are just fundamentally devalued, and that it won't be safe to do a death with dignity bill unless we pair it with actual, you know, like a serious social safety net at the very least. I think that's an argument that people need to consider. And I know in France, it's also an issue where, like, within the Unbowed, there's a kind of wiggle room in the program because the Unbowed program, the Future in Commons, calls for death with dignity as a measure, right? It's part of the thing. It's part of, like, bodily autonomy, mm-hmm. which is part of the program. But the program doesn't go into, you know, all the details of how to implement it, when to implement it exactly. It's, you know, there's a debate about some of the details there. So I think there's, you know, a lot of people who are going back and forth with disability activist groups and stuff like this, trying to figure out how do we actually square the circle. And personally, I think what I'm seeing from like Canada is not great. You know, I'm not like super inspired by that model.
Well, our friend in the Discord, who I won't name, but oi to him, did say that it was something that he looked into, and he did like the program to the extent that he engaged mm-hmm. with it. He is still with us, fortunately, but I was very glad to get that take from someone who not only sort of like looked over it as a policy, but looked into how it actually works for someone who might need to consider it. So in that regard, I sort of defer to him. But I agree with this critique that combined with austerity, there's a sort of grim possibility of its implementation. But would you agree that there's a possibility of it being implemented in a way that does not lead to a eugenic situation?
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay. Because the fundamental sort of like legal or let's take a step back, the sort of like the question of power of like who has the power. I'll give a concrete example. One of my comrades locally is an old like Mao Spontex, and he's in his 80s, and he has friends who are in their 80s. And I'm helping him like clean out the, you know, one of his friends who's in his 80s got Alzheimer's and died recently. Another one got Alzheimer's and has to go, you know, live in an old folks home. And so we've got to move him out of his apartment and get rid of all of his stuff. And I can see my old comrade is extremely disturbed by this because he does not want to, as he says, become a vegetable. Mm-hmm. Right. And he is like one of these people that's in the death with dying associations. And to me, the question of who decides how you go out, like who actually has the power, is a serious issue. You know, in France, the current status quo is basically the doctors kind of have the balance of power. So the doctors can basically do, I mean, I don't know. I didn't prepare to talk about this today, but they can essentially do what a lot of Death with Dignity people would want to be done or not. And it's sort of up to their discretion. And so a lot of disability activists here would say, actually, the status quo is good enough. Whereas the Death with Dignity activists would say, no, in principle, the individual person should have the, you know, freedom to basically, as we say in French, over their own body, the freedom over their own person, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, I would. It's a complicated question because if somebody is in a, you know, brain dead, as they say, who gets to make the decision? I think in the U.S. it's up to next of kin, or if there's no living will. But yeah, let's maybe table this one, and people can read the article at New International Magazine. What's another? There's something by Kate Willett, friend of the show,
about abundance,
the big tech, and the Yimbys,
the Democratic Party.
Yep, the tech takeover of the Democratic Party. We've talked a lot about this as well. And I'm not sure if you saw Ezra Klein's debate with Sam Cedar, but I was a little bit shook by that because our boy Sam didn't knock any knockout punches on Ezra. I think Ezra held up pretty well, despite, you know, my agreement with Kate that this is a very pernicious movement.
Mm. Yeah, I did not see that. I will go check it out. I did listen to Ezra's appearance on Pod Save America and some other appearances of Ezra. I basically I'm kind of two minds of whether or not Ezra is a sort of dissembling when he presents abundance or not. Mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion about that?
No, I don't really know much. I don't really know enough about him to really make that take. I mean, I've heard the accusations this is an AstroTurf movement from the right funded by, Coke style.
I think that's definitely true. It is AstroTurfed. But and when he presents it, I'm not certain. Like Kate in her piece, I think, expresses the idea that Ezra does have good intentions, that he is trying to, do some kind of progressive project here.
Okay.
And I'm not totally sold on that. So when you were asking about heterodox earlier, I wouldn't say that New International is heterodox, because heterodox implies a kind of like there's a line that's orthodox and then your line deviates from that. New International tries to be more of a bigger tent type thing where we bring in a diversity of perspectives. And so
that's what I meant. Maybe that's the wrong word.
Well, I just want to be clear. Like Kate, I respect. I think she did a good article. But I'm not necessarily sold. Like at the end of her article, right, she talks about the Bernie Sanders and AOC speech tour. Mm-hmm. And in the context of her article, it makes sense because she's basically saying, look, there is opposition to this kind of politics. There's an appetite in the country for a different politics, which I agree with. I wonder, though, whether or not the speechifying will actually promote that politics or not. I'm more skeptical than she would be about that, for example. But overall, I think her piece is correct, and this abundance stuff is clearly, you know, it's an attempt to... Like, did you read The Power Broker by New York favorite Robert A. Caro?
I sure have. In fact, I was one of the first people to go to the Robert Caro archives when it opened at the New York Historical Society.
One of my most favorite authors, and I really get the impression that folks think that Jane Jacobs and, you know, the mothers of Central Park or whatever should just shut up and let them build the expressway across Manhattan. You know what I mean? But maybe I'm biased, but that's always the vibe I've gotten. Do you have a particular
it's a good thing to bring up, because in many ways the question that Ezra Klein is trying to solve, at least with this, the housing, the YIMBY issue of abundance, is really figuring out how to undo some of the damage done by Robert Moses, but also using some of Robert Moses's methods of upzoning and density. Moses, of course, had a vision for rebuilding New York. And it was, he was so successful in doing this that really his vision spread the entire country, in which the old world tenement communities would be bulldozed as slums. The poor people, heavily racialized understanding of poor people, would be moved into dense, high-rise project buildings, which could have been better in terms of their architecture and certainly in terms of how they were funded. They were the lack of funding of them really made them bad places to live. But other people would be moved into either public housing that was very suburban, or they would just, you know, buy homes in the peripheries of the city or in the suburbs. And those neighborhoods were zoned single family.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, it's very difficult to build more density, to build enough housing, because so much of the country was suburbanized as a result of the dispersion that sort of spread from Moses's rebuild of New York throughout the entire vision of the country post-war, and the, you know, car culture that comes with that, the inability to build high-speed public transit or public transit in general post-war is something of a result of that too, because, you know, people, NIMBYs don't like it because they've all got cars. Why would they want all this construction work? They want better highways, maybe more highways. So I think the reasonable aspects of what Klein has to talk about and what the YIMBYs in general have to talk about are the proposal of a total upzoning of the entire country so we can build enough housing that could theoretically reduce market rates. And there's another aspect to this. Somebody told me recently in a discussion about this, that left a leftist shibboleth in the United States is that there's way more empty units than there are homeless people. And that may actually not be the case. They argued to me that the way that the numbers for empty units are reported far over-reports them, while the number of homeless people that's used with these homeless censuses far under-reports. So there's way more homeless people than these numbers suggest, and way less housing. In that regard, a major project of building way more housing, either to be given directly to homeless people and low-income people, sounds like a pretty good idea. On the other hand, we're talking about solutions within the market, you know, steering the market in a better direction. Mm-hmm. And
And I think there's also something in the if you listen to how Klein and I forget now the name of his collaborator, when they do interviews and talk about their book, it's not simply the effects that Moses and others of his generation had. And actually, this we should go back to Cairo for a minute. The man is a master or an obsessive about power. Like, did you read his books on Lyndon Johnson?
I've only read The Power Broker, and I read some of his book about writing as well.
No, you got to get off this call with me and go get Master of the Senate immediately. You got to at least read Master of the Senate, because Cairo is completely dialed in these books about how does power, like power in the sense of, you know, public officials holding and parties and stuff, wielding power, work. And I think that's where there's a real conflict with the abundance agenda, because if you think about how did Moses do all of these things, he did them by having these public-private partnerships where there was no red tape, where he could, where at, like the project, the visionary project, could bulldoze over local community groups, all the sort of impediments, which we might call democratic not in the best of ways, a sort of shallow democracy, but are still more democratic than just, you know, the union boss, the construction boss, and Moses getting together in a room and saying, look, we'll paint over this block or whatever, right?
Right. Specifically, Tammany Hall was his major impediment early in his career. He was from the good government school in the progressive era. The Republicans countered Tammany's stranglehold on the northeastern cities with this concept of good government because Tammany was so openly corrupt. And Moses was actually briefly working for, I think, Red Mike Halen was the Tammany mayor at the time, and spent a year with these good government proposals on civil service reform. And then after a year, there was kind of like a shift in the power structure in Tammany, and all of his proposals just got thrown in the trash. This was like in 1916 or something. And so for the next several decades, Moses was just on a mission of like destroying Tammany Hall, and he did. So Tammany did have something like a more directly representative democratic structure. Through its open corruption, there was this ability for like local community strongmen to like present their issues and demands to the Democratic Party and get their things in exchange for working class and immigrant votes.
And let's be clear here. This is also just who was running the thing. Like, this is almost an identity politics argument I'm going to make, but like, I always tell the French people when Al Smith would meet somebody and they'd give him, you know, I'm John Jefferson III, PhD, Harvard, blah, blah, blah. He'd always respond with what? You know this, Andy. Al Smith, FFM. What's FFM?
Female, female, male.
Fulton Fish Market.
I don't remember this story.
You don't know about Al Smith and the Fulton Fish Market? I think he was live. Okay, I'm going to pause the recording. I'm going to verify this. My understanding is that Al Smith, from a young age, worked in the Fulton Fish Market. Mm-hmm. And this is what he had instead of a normal, you know, hoity-toity education. And so when he would meet people that were very proud of their degrees, he would always remind them that he came. Yes, he did. So, all right. I will now read from the Wikipedia. His father, Alfred, owned a small trucking firm, but died when Smith was 13. Aged 14, Smith had to drop out of the St. James parochial school to help support the family and worked at a fish market for 7 years. Prior to dropping out of school, he worked as an altar boy and was strongly influenced by Catholic priests he worked with. He never attended high school or college and claimed he learned about people by studying them at Fulton Fish Market, where he worked for $12 per week. His acting skills made him a success in the amateur theater circuit. He became widely known and developed a smooth oratorical style that characterized his political career. That is why Democrats don't win anymore, Andy. We don't promote fishmongers.
Yeah, I mean, Al Smith was a great populist politician who did not succeed on the national level because he was, I think, too New York coded, but
he was Catholic was the problem.
He was a wet Democrat, as they say, but you know, a lot of the energy and his proposals transferred to Roosevelt and the New Deal. So, you know, he sort of won, his politics sort of won in the end.
And when I said we a moment ago, I did not speak as a member of the Democratic Party, which I am not. I meant as an American, we no longer promote fishmongers to higher office.
I am a registered Democrat, and I will be voting for Democrat Zohran Mamdani next month.
What do you think about Zohran? I had the impression that he was the real deal. He got the Mélenchon endorsement.
I think he's cool. You know, he's like Hassan. I think he's a handsome, cool guy. I do think that he is he's less of a, you know, creature of the Democrat machine, just as a virtue of like how little time he's been in office. As mayor, he's going to have to become more of that part of that machine. This is just the nature of when DSA candidates win in New York, they have to conform to some extent to get anything done. But, you know, and on top of that, you know, a lot of his platform, and he says this himself, is like, this is just de Blasio stuff. You know, if you think I'm radical, maybe you think de Blasio was too radical, but I'm going to try to do some of these de Blasio things. On top of that, he has some more, you know, forward-thinking initiatives like setting up city-run grocery stores that will keep prices low. And his insistence on rent control and freezing rents, you know, obviously appeals to me because I don't want my rent to go up. But he's also something of a YIMBY himself. And it's interesting that the YIMBYs in New York, to my knowledge, have not embraced him despite, you know, him co-signing their platform. Maybe the rent control stuff rubs them the wrong way because a lot of these YIMBYs are really directly working for real estate or you know, working for them for free for some reason.
And that's why I brought up this example of Smith. Like you said, Smith didn't get anything, you know, win at the national level. FDR did say that everything they did in Social Security is based on what Al Smith did in New York.
Right.
So he did bring a major social gain. Now, maybe some people in the audience don't like talking about social gains like this, but I do think it's a real thing that, you know, the 8-hour working day is better than a, you know, 24-hour working day.
I wish and we so had if you go from working day.
What'd you say?
I wish we had the 8-hour working day.
Yeah, you should have the 8-hour working day. And, you know, I think Social Security is a good thing and, you know, it's a social gain. But that was possible because there was a structure of political power that allowed it to be possible, right? And when I look at people like Klein, I think there's a bit of a Mott and Bailey, or at least I suspect, I can't prove. But I suspect there's a Mott and Bailey with the, hey, we just want to fix zoning and actually we're going to, you know, privatize the development and the sort of management of public space completely. And when I look at the response of people like Mamdani, I have a lot of respect. I, you know, he seemed to have an issue with the whole like, do you think the state of Israel should exist or whatever? I mean, I don't want to like wade in and tell him how to handle his campaign or whatever. But I think generally speaking, he seems to be solid. And like if I was a New Yorker, I would vote for him or whatever. But I do sort of question how do Democratic Socialists think that this campaign fits within a broader strategy?
Yeah.
Because like in France, to bring it back to France, we're preparing in the next year to do municipal elections. And the Unbowed are very explicit that we don't believe that we're going to like take power by winning mayor's offices.
Yeah, I think
the idea is that by doing, just to briefly say, the idea is that by competing and winning in mayor's offices, we can use them as sort of examples of like proving our good faith of like, for example, fighting against the privatization of the water network. That's something you can do when you're in the mayor's office. Another thing you can do in the mayor's office is you can work on public transportation and things that impact people's daily lives. So you can sort of prove to the public that, hey, we do what we say we're going to do. And then the second thing is you can sort of experiment in like a new communalism of saying like, well, what if the mayor sets up like a city, you know, an alternative city council that is by sortition? And what if we, you know what I mean? What if we try like to do different democratic means of changing how city government works? Those are things that could be interesting if, you know, the Unbowed win a bunch of small towns or whatever across France. But the overall strategy is not dependent on that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can't really speak to what DSA's overall strategy is. I think you will find some DSA people who would argue that what Zoran's campaign is part of a larger strategy. My impression from most people I know, and I have a lot of friends who are canvassing for him and are excited about his campaign, but even they, their attitude is like, I am sick of Eric Adams. He has been a true disaster for the city. And I don't know if how great Zoran will be or what he'll be able to get done, but we did not have a leftist candidate on the ballot for the last mayoral election. A lot of people who are really excited to vote in that election were kind of just at a loss of like the choices that they had. And as a result of that, Adams won. And, you know, combine that with Cuomo's candidacy. Cuomo is one of the most villainous people in New York, especially hated by people in the city. There is no end to the disgusting things about that man. So people really want to block him from winning. And as of now, Zohran has the best chance of doing it. So yeah. According to a video Zohran released today, as things stand with the ranked chance of voting, when things all shake out, he's polling at 44% to Cuomo's 55%. We've got about a month before the primary, and his argument is there's still about a third of the electorate who hasn't decided yet. So there's momentum on his side, and there's a chance that he can win due to the ranked choice voting.
Is there a rhetoric about abstentionism in New York or not?
No, people will vote or not. There's no concerted effort. People, you know, they pay attention or they don't. The question isn't like how to convince abstentionists to vote. It's because actually I think it's already too late to vote in the Democratic primary.
Oh, okay.
I could be wrong about that. But the question is, how do we activate people who can vote who haven't voted yet, which is Democratic primaries in New York are very, very low turnout. So there's a chance that already, despite what the polls say, Zohran might be ahead because of how excited people are for his campaign.
People think that the Democratic primary is honest?
To the extent that I know that they've cheated in the past, it's been by removing people from the voter rolls. So I don't think that there's a question of like them changing the votes.
Because it makes me think about this article that Ollie Haynes wrote for New International, called Mélenchon versus Hollande, where basically Ollie, who I think you've had on the show before, or not?
I don't think so.
No, he was on Chapo, excuse me. But Ollie basically goes through and talks about basically this new book that's been translated in English, Now the People, and Hollande's book, which has not been translated to English, thankfully, which is called The Challenge of Governing. And they basically have, he retraces this historic opposition within the French Socialist Party that led Mélenchon and the radicals to leave it, right? And to start a new party and new movement outside of that, right? And part of that is the Socialist Party was very corrupt and everything was, the party Congress was about negotiating your score, right? And I think part of the issue is also on what terms are we doing the election? Like you're saying, if there's no abstentionist to mobilize, if it's all within this microcosm of people that are going to vote for the Democrats anyway, there's not really a lot of room for a radical candidate to emerge because typically, at least in this country, I don't know about in America, but typically the people that would be more in favor of a radical candidate are people that are politically disaffected.
So I, despite my, endorsement of Zohran, I guess, just a moment ago, I will refer to another New International piece, The Undying Appeal of Brunch, which I wrote with C. Derek Varn. And in this piece, we, in the shock of Trump's victory, we laid out an argument that we should remember this feeling that we had both in 2016 when he was first elected and last November. And the overall sense that the Democratic Party is a dead end and not get lured back into it.
Yeah.
Now, in many ways, a successful candidacy of Zohran and other DSA candidates poses as a way for people to become reillusioned with the Democratic Party.
Mm.
This is not something I'm particularly worried about right now because there is not this widespread belief like there was during Trump 1.0 that the Bernie wing of the party was ascendant and taking over the Democratic Party. It now appears pretty much common knowledge that the Democratic Party is like hopelessly corrupt and spinning toilet-like around the center and flushing itself away.
Truly incompetent people.
Right. And not only, incompetent in the sense that they don't appear to want to win elections, and when they do want to win elections, they just barely do, and they, you know, they fail on so many basic political levels, but competent in the sense that they keep their jobs within the Democratic Party structure that are not dependent on whether they win or lose. And part of gaining favor with the power brokers within the Democratic Party is crushing the left. And they don't have to do that quite to the extent that they do in the UK, for example. But I think the cynicism with the Democratic Party is far, far higher today than it was at this point of Trump 1.0.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why people like Bernie and AOC don't go harder? Is that they don't want to be go through the Corbyn, Mélenchon ringer of being called anti-Semites every day on TV?
I can't speak to that. I don't. There hasn't been the same amount of rhetoric towards Bernie and AOC. That mostly goes to Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. And, you know, also that kind of rhetoric is just not as effective now as it was, because the actions of Israel are so broadly unpopular that, for example, the recent murder of two Israeli diplomats, I don't think has reached the same level of reaction than it would have prior. Not that people like it particularly, but it's like sort of seen as an element of this horrible war that people wish didn't exist.
Do you remember when there was the whole debate about whether or not the missile that hit the Baptist hospital was Israeli or Islamic Jihad?
Yeah, of course.
There was like a whole, what was it, like a week, 2 weeks of discourse about like people doing like sound analysis. What I mean? There was a lot of effort, and I had people that like I was friendly with previously, and like, look, it's internet friends, sure, but still, people that like sent me recipes, you know, for how to cook octopus good, that like blocked me and called me, you know, blah blah blah, because I was like, this is, you know, clearly unacceptable Israeli aggression.
If somebody is gonna cook an octopus, which is a creature that is as intelligent as a dog, I would already be a little bit skeptical.
This is the problem in our relationship, Andy, is I'm eating too much octopus.
You're a Mediterranean man. I understand. It's part of your
Mediterranean man. It's
part of
culture.
Your folk ways.
It's part of our folk ways.
But I am a vegan Bushwick podcaster, and my folk ways is eating fake fish from Lily's Vegan Pantry in Chinatown, and I am terrified about what the tariffs are going to do to my soy meat imported.
I will ask you a question about this, but I do want to seriously end my comment about the Israel-Palestine, like the treatment of the conflict. I think the fact that, you know, back in the day we were arguing about this one missile strike and assigning, you know, responsibility for it, and that was like a major discourse hot potato. And now, I don't know, it's just like every day, like, oh, look, another devastating panorama of where there used to be urban life flattened, and it just has no real effect. I think the whole thing has gone above discussion of individual events and is like a broiling where, at least in this country and in Europe, I think there's going to be more of a shift at the level of public policy. I think it's possible that more European countries, for example, will recognize the state of Palestine.
Right. And I think France has made some motion in that direction, and Israel's responded by saying, well, if you recognize Palestine, we're just going to annex the West Bank, which they're already going to do. So it's kind of an empty threat.
Yeah, it's a stupid threat. But yeah, and it's also stupid to go to Macron and be like, you're an anti-Semite and all this stuff. It's like they've been trying to call us anti-Semites every day, and now they're getting – it's just the discourse is so ridiculous, and it's actually – people have to recognize that those of us who have been out and protesting and saying this is wrong this whole time, right? Like we were right, actually.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And that's a very uncomfortable place for the discourse. But to go back to your dietary habits, do you consume the noble bivalve?
Those are oysters or clams or
yeah.
Yeah, I have in the past, but you know, I never really liked it. You know, I've heard the Peter Singer arguments that they're not sentient and therefore they're vegetarian, but it's, you know, that's just not the kind of food I like to eat.
Okay.
I am not 100% vegan. I do make exceptions sometimes, but yeah, just clams and stuff like that, I've never really liked.
Shrimp. I was just trying to get an excuse to bring up an old New York political Easter egg. So for those in the know, go to
I
the
don't
Discord,
eat Easter subscribe. Eggs either. You know, it's not about my feelings about the Christian religion. It's just not vegan. So
no vegan eggs. But no, to go back to the serious topics, I think, you know, like I said, we're witnessing a major change, and I think it's going to be increasingly. I saw something like 40% of Israelis are considering leaving the country or something in a poll recently that I saw on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not a good situation.
Hundreds of thousands have left, and you know the polls in Israel are obviously very bleak in terms of Israeli Jews supporting the genocide and ethnic cleansing, close to a majority saying it doesn't go far enough. Now, as you alluded to before, the polls in Europe and the United States are shifting dramatically in the other direction in ways that were unimaginable before October 7th, where people are really disgusted and horrified by Israel. And really, there's no argument left to be made for their actions. There's no the idea that you can never criticize Israel, no matter how openly they desire to murder and purge millions of people from the Gaza Strip and terrify everyone remaining in the West Bank. And also, you know, like a lot of the public wants to get rid of the Israeli Arab citizens as well. There's really no argument left to be made for that other than fuck those people. They're not human beings. They deserve it.
And it's not just a left thing anymore. I mean, look at Justin Amash. I'm always like completely, like for me, that's the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, is when Justin Amash is going out and being like, and for those that don't know, I think he's a former GOP congressman from Michigan.
I don't know who Justin Amash is, but.
Justin Amash, I believe, is a former U.S. congressman from the Republican Party from the state of Michigan, unless I'm mistaken. And he is of Palestinian origin. Mm-hmm. He's from, I believe, a Palestinian Christian family. And he's just on Twitter regularly telling people like, yeah, you know, my Christian cousins and everything are getting killed in Gaza, too. And it's really bad. And to have that kind of discourse from within the Republican Party, I think, is also something that we were not expecting. I don't know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
Well, there is and has been a element of the Republican Party that now calls itself American First. Is nominally anti-interventionist. And it seems like there's some factional fighting going on within the Trump administration about this. And there was some hope that Trump was departing from Netanyahu in certain ways. Now, the Witkoff's recent announcement that the ceasefire deal he was working on is not going to go through as a result of Hamas shitting all over the process appears from drop sites reportings, at least biased reporting, but I think it's probably fairly accurate to be exactly what Biden was doing, you know, ceaselessly working for a ceasefire, tirelessly working for a ceasefire. Right. And then when Hamas agrees to virtually every term, including rescinding all power, disarming, etc., Israel negates on the deal and the United States blames Hamas for it. So in reality, however much Trump and the America First Republicans might signal a divergence from Israel, this is I've seen no actual evidence that things are changing in that regard.
I'm not really sure whether or not Israel is actually the 51st state, as people say, and whether or not Trump can actually make Netanyahu do anything.
The claim is that he could, you know, he could just say we're no longer sending you arms and that'll be the end of it. But beyond just weapons transfers, Israel and the United States are deeply entwined financially, deeply entwined intertwined in terms of foreign policy. So it would be a very difficult decoupling and would take a lot of motivation and political will that politicians will not exert because of the Israeli lobby and the fervency of Zionists in the United States.
I'm also just not sure that Netanyahu actually has an off-ramp. Like, what is Netanyahu actually politically supposed to do? Morally, ethically, we know everything he's doing is wrong and he should, you know, immediately resign and hand himself over to The Hague, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm saying in terms of his sort of political calculus, it seems to me like he's pretty locked into this trajectory and Israeli protests. It's like similar to Putin. What is Putin supposed to do?
He could also go to jail in Israel too. You know, he's facing a number of charges, and it's said that the end of the war will be the end of Netanyahu's career. So yeah, he doesn't exactly have an off ramp either. And his popularity is only growing as he becomes more bellicose in the process. So all the incentives, you know, besides him being a lifelong genocidal racist himself, all the incentives are there for him to continue to the end.
Yeah. So I think this is a piece of this overall narrative. I do believe there's something of a reactionary international. Maybe it's not structured as an actual organization with, like, you know, a program and everything that's concrete, but it is a sort of de facto tendency in politics where we see, you know, Netanyahu, Putin, Trump, all of these people who have a sort of I guess we would say Bonapartist, although Bonapartist seems a bit light, you know, it's a Caudillo. Well, I don't know what the term you want to use, but there's this idea of autocratic personal power over and against any kind of democratic authority. And this is also evidenced in abundance, because part of the problem for abundance is all these neighborhoods, you know, councils or whatever, the weird, like, it's like the school board is the problem. You know what I mean? The moms getting together and saying we don't want the park destroyed is the problem. And I think unless you have a radical left that actually promotes a democratic alternative, we're just going to see more of this deviation, right?
Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. I can't
help it. My grandmama's nerves are bad, and everybody in the hood is mad. Because President Bush could give a damn about her. So I don't want to hear nothing he has to say.
Don't say nothing.
I don't want to hear nothing he has to say.